Okay, that protein powder from 2 weeks ago, it didn't dissolve in the water. That much is true. But also, I was allergic.
Oh, dear. Oh, a real 1-2 punch.
Real 1-2 punch of, oh, man, why am I... there were so many nights where I was like, why am I sniffling as the night goes on?
Is it like soy based, or
I think it's a soy problem. Yeah,
boy, we're discovering so many things you were allergic to over the last few years.
Oh, I think it was the COVID.
Mm-hmm. Oh, you think it fucked up your immune system?
Yeah, I think that's how that works. That's okay. It's just sad I don't get to have soy sauce or soy chicken or tofu or edamame or
soy free soy sauce.
That's just called sauce.
Could just some sauce.
It's just sauce.
It could be any other sauce, you know? Could be sriracha.
Could be any other sauce. I could put ranch. I could put ranch on my sushi. I've done weird things with ranch before.
Put Worcestershire on your sushi?
Yeah.
California roll.
Revisit the times of the mid-90s when the internet was first discovered with The Root Trees Are Dead.
Then in the back half of our show, I've been playing another new game. Have we talked about Pilatro on this show yet?
Oh, the pilgrimage. The pilgrimage continues! Can you not get the tea out?
Thank you for lending me your desk tweezers so I can
lift my tea tweezers.
Tea bag out of this scalding hot tea.
We're having tea right now, and he couldn't get it out. Now I've got to use my tea tweezers.
I tried with my bare fingers at first, but it was still very hot.
Yeah, like that. Bam. Is that really how we're going to start this episode?
Absolutely.
Okay. Welcome to Light Gaming. This is a lighthearted gaming podcast about lighthearted video games, and I am your host of Light. And joining me is the terrible, no good, awful co-host of Light, Alexander Hambrock. I was thinking about that one book, Alexander's No Good, Terrible, Whatever Day.
Oh, yeah, Whatever Day.
I can't remember it. I should have maybe looked it up, but also, say hello.
You know, I am a bit of a bastard, you know, ever since I disowned my parents and then went off to be a movie star and then spent all the family money on acquiring Elvis memorabilia.
No, that's What Remains of Edith Finch. Today, we're talking about The Root Trees Are Dead.
You're right. Those are two different games.
Those are two different games. Tell us a little bit about The Root Trees Are Dead, Alexander.
Yeah, so The Root Trees Are Dead is a very small sort of mystery adventure game in the vein of something like The Return of the Obra Dinn. The developer has openly made that comparison, so I don't think they'll begrudge me making it. Primarily from a developer named Jeremy Johnston with help from Robin Ward. Seems like it's really kind of like a two-person team and a couple of other folks working on art, music, some voice acting stuff. But yeah, it's definitely a game that, you know, shows its budget and shows its small team, but I think uses the resources that it has very effectively. But it's also really good and really fun and really well written and an interesting game about building out an extremely complicated family tree using only clues that you can glean from an approximation of the internet in the mid-90s.
Yeah, so many of our listeners, I would imagine, are a little bit younger than I am. You are still like 3 or 4 years younger than me. So you maybe would have been like 5, I would imagine, when internet was sort of hitting your house.
Yeah, well, 5 to 8. So this was 98, so I would have been 7 at that time.
Oh, okay.
We actually had in-home internet earlier than other folks because my dad was working from home professionally and he was a graphic designer.
Oh, okay.
So he had to be able to email files back and forth and stuff.
Yeah, the way that this game reconstructs the internet to kind of contrive hurdles for you to overcome is really fun and satisfying and nostalgic in a lot of ways. There is a search engine, but you're not going to get pictures from that search engine. You're not going to get results from every single magazine or every news publication or every blog post because these things didn't exist. What did exist were disparate collections of information such as periodicals and random GeoCities websites and other stuff, other fan sites that were hobbled together through various means for people to start to, in a nascent fashion, express their admiration for certain forms of art. And it plays a lot of these nostalgic beats to pay homage to the early days of the internet and a genealogical sleuthing. So the premise of this game is that there is just there's a plane crash of a family of really, really well-known family. Think of like a Kardashian plane crash. If all the Kardashians happened to be in the same plane that went down, it would be pretty big fucking news, right? And there's a mystery that is presented to you to determine the entirety of the root tree. That's their name. The root tree, family tree, blood relatives only,
which is quite big. It is 50 people.
Yes, it's about the same kind of size as Oberdin. But if we are going to compare this game to Oberdin, we must also compare the visuals and aesthetics. I think that cohesively, this game does succeed in terms of setting the vibe just right. Once the gameplay loop goes in, the jazz music on the radio is playing and the clues are all in place. The formerly AI art when it was on itch.io has been replaced with commissioned art that is pretty cool.
Oh, good for them. Yeah, I didn't know that.
Yes, and the cork board that you're tying strings to, the internet, the CRT monitor that you're looking at these old websites on with their old Windows-esque icons, all of it is there. But there is a certain lack of polish that comes from this being an itch.io truly solo dev project.
This is about as solo as it gets. Mm-hmm. Like, it's the number of people who have touched this thing is probably like less than five.
Yeah, the guy, I mean, pretty, I would imagine that the guy at the start who is just reading the news was just somebody on his phone. The guy
oh yeah, no, the great bit earlier on, I was like, is this an FMV game? And it's not really. Mm-hmm. But it does have a great FMV clip.
Yeah, it's so if you're comparing that to Return of the Oberdin, you're not going to get that same level of like Lucas Pope plus whomever else level of finish and cohesion, but it is still,
I mean,
Hoops
Among
own
Us is
thing.
Lucas Pope.
Yeah, it's, I mean, props to Jeremy Johnston for just getting this thing out the door and making it and completing a very, very compelling mystery narrative with a really, really clever twist and iteration of the Oberdin framework.
This is one of those games that, like, I want to talk about a lot of specifics in this game, but in general, This is one of those games that, like, it makes me really excited for whatever this guy does next. Because
for sure,
this game appears to be doing fairly well. Like, it's getting a good amount of buzz. Like, I'm hearing other people talk about it, and it's got, like, really good Steam reviews, and it's starting to get some traction. And, like, I hope that, like, not even, like, a big budget game, but just that, like, this gives him a bit of momentum to take another swing at doing, like, a narrative sort of, like, mystery or something like this, or whatever else he wants to do. And I'd like to see what he could do with the constraints loosened up just a little bit.
Yeah, and I mean, what I really find fascinating about this game is just my own documented here search through my own family tree, which resulted in me finding something that, of course, my father already well knew. I probably could have, had he just elucidated me sooner, I wouldn't have had to go digging for my own family tree, but then ending up with the fireship Captain Barbatsis. And it's so inspiring to find that kind of thing. But I also makes me wonder about my family tree and all this crazy stuff that probably goes on in the second or third cousin realm.
Well, and it's interesting because in the context of the narrative in the game itself, it's not even necessarily that, like, that various family members themselves want to learn about the family.
No.
If anything, they almost feel imprisoned by it. Like, there is this real sense that, like, being a root tree has defined the lives of everyone who is part of this sprawling sort of, like, you know, collection of people, sometimes in good ways and sometimes in not very good ways.
Yeah. I don't want to even spoil. It's just one of those games where the less we say, the better, but also we have a show to do. So without getting into specifics of characters and stories, what the things that you'll discover once you are going through this, you'll find that, you know, people have left maybe either various creative or otherwise published works in their wake. And you, like a really good history class or good history lecture, begin to slowly uncover the pages of this family's history and the members within it and their relationships with each other over the years. And it all builds up to I would say climactic sort of secret hidden locked thing on, yeah, on the root tree, similar to Overdin. It's just a hidden thing, and you don't know why it's hidden. You don't know why it's there. You're not really kept in the loop of why you're doing it, but unlocking the things, unlocking the people, their pictures, their jobs, and their names is so satisfying that it almost doesn't matter at first that you don't really know why you're doing what you're doing.
Yeah, well, and to that secret, like, I'm not going to spoil it, obviously. I think that everyone should, like, discover it on their own. But, like, for a story that is about this big, rich family with all these different sort of, like, colorful characters and stuff, I think it is the correct decision and sort of, like, a satisfying decision that the big secret at the center of everything is not sensationalist. It's not that someone was a serial killer. It's not that someone was a Russian spy. It's not some sort of like big pulpy dramatic thing in that way. It's just the kind of thing that like that can happen in families that can cause sort of like, you know, pain to ripple down through generations. And it's the kind of thing that like a lot of families, especially sort of like, you know, in these modern eras when we're doing the kind of stuff that you're talking about, like, you know, digging back and like a really understanding family history and stuff like that, can like, it's the kind of thing that people end up needing to have to sort of like grapple with and address.
Yeah. It's truly fascinating. And the way in which you're allowed to freeform move between discovering things, looking at your evidence, and finding out bits and pieces of different family members and whether or not they connect at all is really fun. And there are a couple of other puzzles interspersed in certain aspects of the family tree as well, in ways that are really funny, I think. And let's talk a bit about the writing itself. The writing itself is pretty funny. There are some times where I felt, okay, like, it's a little too tongue-in-cheek for my taste, or it's a little too telling me how to feel about this.
Occasionally.
It does break the fourth wall a little bit, but...
Okay, there are a couple, like, genuine meta moments where the text is just like, I'm the developer of this game, I thought this would be funny.
Yeah, pretty much. And that's fine. The developer does a good enough job of writing other periodicals and diary entries and things like that in the voices of other characters, such that I forgave the search engine self-insert moments. So I thought I really, really, really enjoyed it. I love a game like this where the writing allows the person to discover and interpret and journey in different ways. And I think that's where this game succeeds a little bit. Maybe in some way succeeds over Overdin, in that Overdin, while it wasn't strictly railroading, it kind of was, in a sense, where you're like, okay, you discover certain bodies and then other bodies just become visible as you do other things, and
yes,
then they're just kind of like hard railroading you. This game just presents you with evidence, and it's up to you to look and see what you see in that evidence and then come back and see things with new eyes. And it's a lot more open-ended that way.
And like, there are some gates that like keep you, I think, from like being able to lock certain people in based on like information the game hasn't given you yet.
Yeah, but it's not hard-coded that you could never do anything like that, or it's
totally
possible.
Exactly. And like, and a lot of the times, like, you can like, you're already kind of feeling around the edges and sort of like maybe getting a portrait or getting a name, and like the new stuff they give you just kind of like helps you sort of like lock the whole thing in, but you've already got a sense of kind of like what you were about to learn.
I had several satisfying moments, not only of just locking things in, but also of finding new resources on the internet to use. I think that was an extra layer of satisfaction
the
that
periodicals
this game has
and the books
is,
and stuff.
Yes. So that was like, those were like more surprising. Like, I expected to be satisfied because of the Overdin thing. So it was really cool for not only to be satisfied by the portrait locking, but also with just discovering what was available for me to peruse. It felt like just a little kid in a candy shop. Like, ooh, there's a whole new book for me to read.
Every time,
and
you
I'm
like,
not a reader.
Every time you find something like in your search and you hear like your printer making noise and it's like, this has been added to your evidence, and you're like, yeah, I get to go look at a new thing.
And what a cast of characters it is. But without, again, getting into it too much, all I can say is The Root Trees Are Dead is a pretty spectacular game, and it's worth supporting. If you like Overdin, you'll like this. If you like puzzle, like narrative puzzle games, mystery games, you'll definitely like this. Very, very good vibes. great Kevin MacLeod, great use of Kevin MacLeod jazz music throughout the entire thing.
Yeah, good music. Can I read you like one of my favorite little search excerpts? Like,
yes,
no,
please
no spoilers
do.
In here.
No, yes.
Randomly, I was researching 90s sitcoms, and I looked up the actor Dustin Christopher Baker.
I saw this too.
Dustin Christopher Baker is often abbreviated DCB by his teenage fans. Since leaving the show Brother Trouble, he has appeared in a few straight-to-VHS movies that adapt classic literature to a family audience with minor success. The most popular of which was Jane Eyre, which reimagined the Charlotte Brontë novel as a high school romance with a focus on skateboarding.
Yes, so that was such a good joke, and I'm glad that he bothered to put it in. There's not too many of those, but I also really liked there's an intentional red herring that the game throws at you right at the start with the guy who just happens to be named Root Tree.
Oh, yeah, I love that, right? That one was a- I kind of wondered if that was going to come up again, like if there were even more red herrings like that, but no, he's the one red herring.
I don't know, you'll have to play the game to find out.
Okay. Oh, I don't know, you'll play the game to find out.
It's so funny. So it's good, it's charming, it's funny, it's impactful, it is thought-provoking in a lot of ways, and a highly successful triumph. Really good for light gaming. Took me, I don't know, fucking 4 or 5 hours to get
through. 6 hours about for me.
Yeah, maybe six. I probably had it open for a while.
Good hint system that, like, I just, like, a couple of times I just let myself be like, okay, look, I just want to figure this out. Give me a couple of hints.
Yeah, I did. When I came back the second day, I was like, where was I? And I just did. But it does give you a chance to rubber duck a bit.
Literally rubber duck. Yeah, it's great.
How do you feel about the intuition system that this game has? There's a magnifying glass underneath every evidence that has a raw number underneath it to kind of give you guidance as to how many clues are associated with a piece of evidence. How did you feel about that system?
I didn't get it at first. Towards the back half of the game, I ended up finding it very useful once I was sort of able to be like, okay, like this was at a 6 before, but now it's down to a 2. Well, especially with like the multi-page books, the fact that every page had a different number associated with it. So I could be like, okay, I've found everything on this page. I found everything on this page. There are 2 things here that it thinks I still haven't figured out yet. So let me like focus on this page and like pour over the text a little bit. Once I figured out that that was the way to use it, it was very helpful. But for the first half of the game, I was kind of befuddled by it.
I think I have the same opinion. And what do you think about the optional stuff? Did you manage to get every optional person?
Oh, no. I didn't bother with every optional person. Mostly, the optional stuff was like a way to sort of like do cleanup almost. What I liked about the optional stuff was that it meant that like every single person who showed up, even peripherally, did go into the database, right? You had their portrait, you had their name, you had like other info about them, right? And then like, and that meant that like it kept it from being too obvious sort of like who the important characters were, because you did have all this kind of like other folks who had to kind of filter through. But then by locking optional people in, by getting their names and then their portraits, you could then do like a clearing out of that, of sort of like trimming stuff back down in order to like, you know, in order to simplify back and like, and do the work of identifying who was important, as opposed to the game just telling you who was important.
And I think this game, with that and with the sheer number of professions and photos you find, it does a good job of making it such that you can't necessarily brute force an answer, unlike a game like Golden Idol. Or even Oberdin at certain points where like, all right, like I can, now that I've brute forced or done, now that I've gotten so many, I can kind of click on the rest and figure it out from there. Just sort of game the system. I think this game does a really good job of keeping it open-ended even until the last few family members.
Yes.
Like there's only a couple that you absolutely had to solve through process of elimination. And then there are some family members that get more screen time than others, for sure.
Yeah, I mean, there were a couple times where I was like, okay, I think these two people have 2 male names and I don't quite know which is which, so I'm just going to like try one, then try the other and see if it locks in. But like, I didn't do that very often.
Yeah, I think the only times I really had to do that were maybe for some of the ages of things, just because, of course, everything goes from left to right. And I had some of them wrong.
Oh, sure. Like, who's the older, who's the younger sibling?
But like, other than that, yeah, it was... The rest of it, I felt like I was figuring it out with the clues that the game was giving me. Anything else you want to say about the Root Trees Are Dead before we move on?
I think this game is neat.
This game is really neat. Check it out on the Steam. There's one thing I want to say. is that it would it first opened in this wild resolution that did not match my monitor in the window, and then like, you have to like go in and
like
do the
smaller
settings.
Or bigger
huge
or?
It was just like It was just massive over there, and I had to kind of fandangle it and find a way to get it in there. It's not particularly perfectly polished in terms of the client either,
yeah,
so mm-hmm. be wary of that, but otherwise still a neat game. Okay, we've got, of course, our sponsored segment, and then after that, we are going to maybe dig up an old segment from the old segment graveyard. We'll see you then.
Jerome, are you planning any big parties coming up?
Absolutely not. I'm canceling my parties.
You're canceling your parties? Aren't you going to have a housewarming party when you move?
Don't out me.
When you do, won't you need things for your guests to eat?
Oh, they could feed themselves.
What if
there's a grocery store downstairs.
What if I told you that you could feed them with Nachitas?
What if, man?
Nachitas are the brand... Look, I have four bullet points here. I'm going to hit them, okay?
Oh, God. Oh, we're getting paid by these. Okay.
Nachitas are the brand new tasty crispy snack that is all the rage up and down the West Coast. And they're finally, bringing distribution here to grocery stores in the Midwest.
They're the small feminine nacho?
No, they're like... Okay, so you know what nachos are. Okay, right? So like corn... Heard. You've had corn chips. Right. You dip salsa in them and stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
So Nachitas are like corn chips, but in the bag, they're also tossed with like a cheesy powder that makes them taste kind of like nachos. And, I sent me a package of these actually, and like the flavor is incredible. It's like nothing I've had before. It really sort of, it's addictive almost. Like I went through an entire bag on my own.
Oh.
And yeah, like real testimonials here. And, they're, health focused. They're produced primarily with natural and artificial ingredients.
Like what?
Like,
okay.
Dextrose and sucrose and soybeans, which I guess is maybe a bit of a problem for you.
Yeah.
But,
oh well. You keep looking at me, man. I don't know. This is the first I heard of this shit. You're just like staring at me.
You're not.
You're right. You're right. I'm not.
You're not interested in the exciting new snack food Nachitas.
Thanks for the paycheck, I guess. I don't know.
Anyway, Nachitas, the newest innovation in snacking.
I don't eat food. I have lettuce, and then I dunk that lettuce in like slightly warm water to give like half the lettuce and slightly warm water to give it like a different texture than the cold lettuce.
I mean, you might enjoy they're actually launching, I think later this summer, they're launching Nachitas Veggie Max, which are deep fried lettuce slices that have been then dipped in nacho cheese powder.
Okay. What's so that nacho cheese powder, is that like Coke or what?
No, it's like it's made of Pepsi.
Oh, that's it. That's it. So
it's like they take Pepsi. They mix like the nacho cheese with the dried Pepsi, and then they dry it out under these heating ovens. They have a video actually. It's like an old like Mr. Rogers segment. They walk you through the factory. It's really cool. And like they dry out the mixture of the Pepsi and the nacho cheese into fine powder, and they pulverize it in these big sort of like like a mortar and pestle type thing. So it's like mechanical. Mm. And then they throw the chips or the deep fried lettuce slices, as it were, in, and they put it in a bag.
Okay. I'll pass.
Well, I will bring a big bag of Nachitas to your home warming party, and I will feed all your guests.
Thanks, I guess.
Because that's what our sponsor wants to hear this week.
Apparently, this is tradition among people. It's the first I've heard of it.
You came to our housewarming party. You gave me a giant slab of honeycomb that we're still using like 3 years later.
Yeah, that was a joke.
Nachitas, the cheesy, crispy snack.
Well... We're back from the segment graveyard, and boy do we have a doozy with us. That's a long recurring segment, and it's coming back now because I couldn't think of anything else. That's right. It's time to press that J key. It's time to open up that journal and bust out whatever our side quests are.
I play Monster Reborn in a spell card slot.
That's true. That's exactly what happened because you had given us a hint at the start, and I didn't contradict you because I was like, you were right. We're talking about the games we were playing outside of the main episode. Holy cow.
Yeah, I got two of them this week.
And I mean, I got one.
I mean, yeah, well, should we do the big one first? Should we'll I do my Blotro segment? First.
We're going to dive into our podcast within a podcast, Heavy Gaming. Because this game is not
like the game that I've already put like 22 hours into over the course of one weekend.
Over the on my birthday, Capcom finally released Monster Hunter Wilds, and Monster Hunter is a game that is near and dear to both of our hearts. Brought us closer together during Magic Nights as well. I started at Monster Hunter 3. You probably started way sooner.
No, also Monster Hunter 3.
Okay, man,
well, because it was on the 3DS. Because that was the whole thing was that Perry just showed up one day and was like, "Hey,
Perry with the good hair."
Yeah, it was like all of you guys should buy Monster Hunter, and so we all bought Monster Hunter.
he pretty much strong-armed us into playing it, and then he tried to strong-arm us into doing the 3D for the underwater fights, and then we all got sick except him.
One of my top five video game experiences of all time really is getting like four people who are playing Monster Hunter together in the same room together. It is like the online play is great and we have a lot of fun with our friends in voice chat and stuff, but like sitting in a room all on your separate devices playing Monster Hunter is fucking rules.
It's something else. But specifically talking about Wilds, it is a game that I've been looking forward to for a very long time. If you are new to the Monster Hunter franchise, welcome! This is the most welcoming entry in it thus far because there is a 10-hour tutorial campaign that you must go through that I just finished last night.
Oh boy, must you.
Yes, you must go through it. So if you're a fan of a game called Final Fantasy XIV, you might be familiar with a similar thing. But I'm going to just be honest, I don't think the writing is quite as good.
Nope. When we hopped on chat on like Saturday and y'all just told me you'd been skipping the cutscenes, the wave of relief that washed through my body like, oh, I could skip the cutscenes too. I don't need to be paying attention to this.
So the game itself, if you're unfamiliar with it and the franchise, is a third-person perspective action RPG fantasy where you take up the mantle of a hunter and you hunt various massive behemoth dragon toad octopus monsters, all under various esoteric names. Many of them have different elements to them, so you might fight a fire dragon or a water opossum or a dragon tern. And
the guy who's like, his whole body's a balloon and he sucks up oil. Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of fun, interesting character and monster designs in this game if you can put up with some derivative moments in just action. It's just sort of a generic action movie that takes 10 hours to get through. So if you're into that kind of thing, you'll enjoy the first 10 hours of this game. I just want to play it for the combat and the glory because the combat is intricate and interesting and developed and a machine and esoteric at times, but accessible at other times. There are 14 different weapon styles that you could choose from, all of which play like different classes in an MMORPG. Really, like you have different rotations, you have different places that you want to be on the battlefield. You'll fulfill different roles. Some are more supportive than others. Some are able to take hits without getting knocked down more than others. And some are very nimble. And some, some are just so odd.
The hunting horn.
The hunting horn is...
Your weapon could be a giant cello that you use to whack the monster with in between playing notes that produce buffs.
It's definitely... I mean, it's a bard class, so there's a lot of... I think crossover and interest between the two communities. And the reason, of course, if somehow you don't know, that is, of course, the large majority of our listener base was Final Fantasy XIV players from our previous podcast. So that's why we're making those comparisons. But I'm still really enjoying this game. I think that it's a solid like 9 out of 10 for me. It's just not going to be a 10 out of 10 because I don't really care about the characters or the dialogue or anything that much.
Yeah, I mean, Monster Hunter games, I think.
That's just, they've always been this way, though. So yeah. It's like, I'm not mad about it. I'm just like, here we go, you know?
Yeah, it's like, there's no reason for the story to be this much of a focus. I do miss the old days when it's kind of like, you're part of a village. There are monsters outside. They might damage things. The village needs to stay alive. Go do something about that.
And once the story is gone, and finally, I feel the freedom to explore without being tethered to these escort quests, I'm having a lot more fun discovering and appreciating the world and navigating the world. I'm not feeling quite as lost because I'm not, again, just being led down what is this long hallway of a sequence. Granted, there are moments where you can go out and explore on your own, but then that does, that just feels, that just makes the story even more awkward when you go back into it.
Yes.
That's how I feel.
Kind of frustrating. So there are three things I want to say about Monster Hunter really quick. I mean, the first is just that, like, this is probably, like, my favorite video game action combat ever. Like,
oh, so good.
I think it's this and, like, Sekiro Shadows Die Twice are probably the two. Like, like nothing else plays quite like these games. There's so much sort of, like, it's not even just that there's depth to it. It's also the fact that, like, okay, I guess it's kind of the second point I wanted to make, which is this game has a lot of new monsters in it, and those new monsters are pretty much all of them really cool and have interesting gimmicks and are fun to fight. But also, between the ones that are returning and the fact that even the new ones are often kind of built on sort of a conceptual base that the series has been running on for like 20 years at this point, almost untouched in some ways, there is like... there is a real feeling of skill that I have. I've been hunting like Rathaloses for like 12 years at this point. I know how they move. Mm-hmm. I know like I can see in like the way that the body rears back exactly which kind of attack is about to happen and dodge out of the way at the last second. It is possible to learn very intimately the way in which these giant creatures move around and defend themselves and sort of like try to attack you. And that and getting good at that is deeply, deeply satisfying.
Getting good at that is deeply satisfying, and getting good at that in new and interesting ways in Monster Hunter Wilds is also satisfying. A lot of the heavier weapons have something called offset attacks now, wherein once you learn a monster's attack patterns and you learn their timing, and then you learn your own weapon's timing, if you clash with a monster at a perfect time with your offset attack, you will topple them over instead. You will use their own gravity against them and create an opportunity for you and your team to hit the thing in the places you want to hit it. That is really satisfying. There is also a new wound system wherein monsters were get wounded before, but now you can highlight them and do special focus attacks on those wounds to really twist the knife, as it were, and feel like a total badass. And those are actually very easy to execute once you get it going with the new focus mode. And so this game does a lot in both ways to make the hunter feel like a total badass, wherein you can either learn the monster's attack patterns, parry them with the difficult to execute offset attacks, get openings that way, or just hit the damn thing, right? It's weak to damage, hit it until wounds open up, and then use your wound breaker to create openings that way. Literal openings in their skin, I suppose, if you think about it that way.
And you feel like a total badass, and then you let your guard down for 1 sec and eat shit.
Yes, some of these, some of the later fights do get to, and again, I'm not super deep into high rank, but even some of the later fights of the story do start to chain you a little bit. If you take too many hits in a row, you get stunned, and I was getting stunned. I'm definitely a reckless hunter.
Oh yeah.
For me, I like to push the limits, and I like to try and see what I can get away with, especially at these lower ranks when the stakes are not quite so high and the hunts don't necessarily take 45 minutes and there's not a lot to lose by just dying.
Oh yeah. I rolled longsword all the way through low rank because I was just like, I just want DPS. Just give me like maximum DPS.
So longsword is a weapon that caters to the weeb fantasy, the anime Neo, you know, Sekiro Shadows Die Twice fantasy, I guess, of samurai. And that's super cool. I just can never commit to something, but this playthrough, I played a lot of bow at the start, realized it was way too easy and way too strong for low rank just to be able to constantly wound check and crowd control people. And while I was having fun doing it, I wanted to take the opportunity to play weapons that were maybe harder to use. While the monsters were easier, so I switched over to hammer and switch axe. They've kept hammer the same pretty much the whole time, and hammer felt like hammer. But switch axe has some new goodies in it, and switch axe ended up being the one I stuck with the most all the way until the end, which was a pretty bombastic fight. So I've really Thus enjoyed my time thus far. It will be cool to continue playing multiplayer with all of our friends going forward. But we have one other game you want to talk about.
Well, I was going to say one last thing on Monster Hunter also.
Okay.
Because I think especially relevant to some of the games we talked about over the last year or so. Mm. This is my preferred way of doing a loot system. I really like how the loot works in these games. Like the way that it works in the Monster Hunter games is that you get random drops off of the monsters that you kill, but they're all parts. They're all like, you know, claws or fangs or plates or scales and stuff like that. And those are crafting materials that you use to then make weapons and armor from a defined list of weapons and armor that are preset in the game with attributes and elements and abilities and stuff like that. And I just like, I like that better, I think, than the stuff like a Diablo or even like a Final Fantasy 14. I guess Final Fantasy 14 is more, not quite like this, but like Diablo, where like everything is randomized and it's like, you know, getting like, you're getting a sword and the sword has random perks on it.
Yeah, Final Fantasy 14 is less like, you just don't get to choose which class of gear drops, whereas these are all parts that you can reuse for pretty much any of the weapons or any of the perks or anything like that, because none of the armors are class locked anymore, thank God. they used to separate the ranged and melee weapons out, and everyone was like, no need for that, really.
Yeah, but like I like looking at a sword on the crafting list and knowing what I'm going to get when I craft that sword.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, the other game I want to talk about is, yes, because it came to Apple Arcade, I was playing some Balatro over the last couple of days.
Well,
I admire this game a lot. I admire it the way that like you admire like a really sharp knife. Like it's it's so, I can already see how meticulously crafted it is. And it's designed for one purpose, which is to make big numbers. And like, and it's cool that someone has produced possibly the most satisfying game ever made for producing big numbers. And we're going to see how far watching the number get big is going to get me. Because it's kind of like, it is just that.
it is that, but it's also a collect-a-thon.
Yes, and unlocking new jokers and new decks and new abilities and stuff like that. Like,
then also in service new difficulties of, to make it so that you can see how fast you make number go up, as well as other restrictions as well. So it puts things up.
Yes, giving you lots of yes, I'm being a bit simplistic here.
Make number go up, yeah.
But like all the stuff around it, it is the best that I've seen, right? Like it is like in terms of like this sort of roguelike structure of like you unlock stuff that persists between runs, you get things that give you different sort of conditions and multipliers that like switch up the gameplay in various different ways. Like, yeah, I can already see that like the level of depth in here is incredible. I've gotten to Anti-8. I have not yet beaten it because the jump to 300,000 was a little bit, I got to like 120 my first time trying it. I was like,
it's okay. It'll unlock once you get the more busted jokers and doing all the achievements and stuff.
Well, and so that's my question is like, because I am trying to figure out, like, how much, as I'm trying to make progress in this game, am I just kind of, like, going through runs to unlock stuff that is going to make it easier to, like, hit those synergies? Because, like, I can already see that there are jokers in here where it's like, okay, barring some specific circumstances, the one that, like, gives me, like, 3x multiples every time I play a diamond or whatever, like, it's nice, but, like, I don't need to hit 3x multiples. I need to be hitting, like, 30x multiples. So, do I need to be, like, finding more ways to just sort of, like, pull off inter-joker synergy to, like, make those work combinatorially?
It depends on the run. Depends on the deck, and it depends on what you're given. It's a game that is going to test you to be able to work with what you're given, or what you give yourself, depending on which deck you choose to play the game or which challenge you're doing, to be able to succeed. I mean, I can succeed at this point pretty much with any stipulation on a white stake run at this point, because I for progress update, my pilgrimage is still continuing on completionist plus plus. I'm down to 7 jokers left out of 150 to gold stake.
I don't know what any of that means.
So, well, there's 150 jokers, and every time you beat a run, you get a stake on one of your jokers, and the stake corresponds to the color of the difficulty. The gold stake is the highest difficulty.
Got it.
It's like difficulty 8 or 9. I can't remember. So you got to beat... That means I've beaten every deck all the way up, you know, 8 times all the way to get the first completionist plus, right? Completionist plus plus is now getting every single Joker, including like the perishable ones like popcorn and whatever other ones you run at to the end of the run at eight stakes, right? That's it. So I'm almost done with that. I'm very, very good at this game now at this point. I'm also very bad at this game because I get bored of it and I just want to do stupid shit. It's like, oh yeah, okay.
That's half the fun. I'm still in the phase of like, I think this Joker might be bad, but I'm going to take it anyway to see what happens.
There's still optimizations I still have to do where I'm like, why did whatever. This game can be optimized forever. And skill can be done. Like skill is developed at, and just evaluating Jokers better than others, evaluating things. Like I've got other friends into this game who are, for instance, really into like the splash Joker. They're like, wow, this is one of the best Jokers in the game, surely. And I'm like, nope. Shit's bad. Unless you're doing a specific thing, then it's like, all right, then it's a good option for that specific thing. But there's a lot of there's obviously a lot of resources. If you get completely stuck, you can watch crazy people play. But I would just sit with it and continue playing it on the toilet or whatever you're doing on your commute on your Apple Arcade. Just pick at it for a while and let it exist in your life without letting it take over your life. And it's hard. That's hard to do. There comes a point where suddenly you're unlocking a lot of things.
I did play it for like 3 hours in a row, and then I was like, okay, we're gonna take a break here. We're gonna make sure that I measure my time.
It's a
good
ass game, man. It's a good ass game.
I'm gonna say this, having only played it for like 2 days at this point. I think, yeah, it deserved to win Game of the Year. This is the game...
Neither of us have played Astrobot, so...
Sure, but like, but this is the game
that
of
the... It was the Game of the Year.
It's the game of the moment. Like, when I talk about it being sort of like a perfect knife or whatever, it is in many ways like the utter distillation of many different sort of like, systems and mechanics that have been kind of like swirling around and like finding their way into like just about every kind of video game genre over the last 4 or 5 years, and they're all just here, and this is just the game that is just doing the most with them.
Yeah, and speaking of swirling around, man, that music.
Oh yeah,
that's a real 7-8 earworm, or 7-4. I don't know what it actually is.
I did turn the CRT effect down a little bit.
Oh, yeah, the shake is a lot. Do you like the shake?
The shake and all the lines.
I like the lines. I don't like the shake.
Lines are giving me a headache.
All right. Well. I mean, that's good enough for me. I like this game, too. I've been talking about it for... I dreamt about it, remember? Like, I was dreaming about this game. I was obviously very obsessed when it first came out. So I'm happy to see that you're in it. And if you're in it, too, if you haven't given that game a shot, or Monster Hunter, or The Root Trees Are Dead, and you give it a shot because of us, let us know. You could talk to us at our email, Light Gaming Podcast, or in our Discord. All of the links of our socials are in the description of the episode. Next week, we are talking about Neva. Neva is the game. It is a very touching story game that I really just wanted to touch on last year when it came out, but we never had the time for it. And so we're making time for it now.
Have you played it already?
No.
Okay, cool. But it's beautiful looking.
Yeah, it's a beautiful looking game. Play it along with us. It should only be a couple hours for just a little bit of light gaming. Well, thank you all so much for having listened to this week's episode of Light Gaming. We're going to close the books on this one. Here we go. I'm closing it now. That was a book and not something else.
One of the many books that you own.
I own so many books. At least 3. The books were the first thing I packed in my move. I could tell you I was not accessing those until the move.
You are the friend who owns 3 books. I am the friend who owns 300
books. You have
books.
So many books, and that's cool. I think that's cool that we're different people with different tastes. But until the next episode of Light Gaming, I have been your host of Light, Jerome Barbatsis, and I was joined by my co-host of Light, Alexander Hambrock. Say goodnight to the gamers of Light.
Good evening.